painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Today on Artbeat, we interview an individual who is mostly known currently as a filmmaker for The Price of Sand. This individual started out as a cameraman, moved into installation art, and then found narrative as his main way of expressing himself. Today, in part one of this episode of Artbeat, we'll find out how this individual became interested in photography, and we'll learn about a gallery he started in Minneapolis at a location called the Skunk House, which was named the No Name Gallery and is currently now known as the Soap Factory. You're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tenseth. Hi, you're listening to Artbeat, and I've finally cornered Jim Tittle to talk to us about the many different things that he does. Some people have known him to be a cameraman or a filmmaker, a documentarian, but he's also many other things, including installation artist, which I found out. You can find his stuff on minnesotaartists.org if you search for him. But welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining me today on a weekend.
Glad to.
Yeah. And let's start at the beginning, because that's usually where everybody goes. Yeah.
Okay.
So how would you best describe yourself in your field?
As a 56-year-old man.
Great. That works. What got you interested in media?
You want to go way back.
I want to go way back.
I had an uncle, a great uncle named Virgil Norbert Thompson, who gave me a camera one Christmas when I was about 11, and I started taking pictures of it and got interested in photography, and I lived in Red Wing, and this was in the 60s, and I started checking books out of the library about, I wanted to learn more about how to make pictures. I already drew and everything, you know, and one thing led to another, and pretty soon I had a dark room in the basement. And I would go down to the corner, the Rexall drugstore, and talk to Berkeley, the pharmacist, who was an avid photographer. And Berkeley would tell me what I was doing wrong. And he would order chemicals and things from me from Kodak, you know, from my darkroom. And that's how I learned photography. I kind of taught myself. And then when I was, 15 years old, I shot some pictures of my brother with a group. They were rock climbing in Red Wing. It's the Red Wing Environmental Learning Center, which is still there. And they were out rock climbing, and I shot pictures of my brother and these kids rock climbing, and there was a news reporter there from the local newspaper. And she was taking pictures, too. And we talked a little bit. She left, and the next day I got a call from the editor, and the editor said, "We don't have any good pictures. Can we buy some of yours? Can you send some over?" So I sent them. And the really gratifying, surprising thing was they called me back, and they said, "We're going to use some. We'll send you a check. And by the way, how old are you?" Well, I was 15. They said, "When you turn 16 and get your driver's license, call us. We might have a job for you." So I became a junior photographer at the newspaper. They gave me a press pass, and I went out and photographed all the things that the regular photographer didn't want to photograph.
Interesting.
Yeah. They gave me a key to the newspaper office so I could go in and use the darkroom anytime I wanted. I had a cabinet full of Nikons and all the film I could shoot. And that's how I learned photography.
That'd be kind of a dream come true for a teenager, wouldn't it?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, I learned by doing stuff. So I shot a lot of film when I was in my teens. I just shot, you know, miles and miles of black and white film. So that's how I learned technical stuff. And then, of course, the editors, you know, if they didn't like a picture, they weren't shy about telling me.
Did you take that feedback well?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, they'd say, "You got to do this differently." Or another funny thing is I've never been an athlete or a sports guy, but I ended up shooting a lot of high school sports. So I just basically learned you follow the ball, you make sure you get a program so you know who's who. You know, and then afterwards you write the cut lines on the picture. You know, you write down what happened. And half the time the sports guys say, you know, "They're not doing that." But at least I had the names right. And then they'd write the caption. So I never really did learn much about football or baseball or anything. But I did learn where the ball goes.
One end to the other.
Right, right. Right, exactly. You try to get action, you know. Yeah.
What did you do after that to keep pursuing?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a scholarship to a university in the Twin Cities, and I went there and thought, you know, I'm probably going to be an attorney. That's what.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because of, you know, aptitude testing and what I was interested in. Because I had a lot of interests. And after the first semester, you know, I was running the student photo bureau, and I was, I mean, my photography kind of started to take over, and I was also, you know, taking art classes, and I just decided that I didn't fit there. So then I went to the University of Minnesota, and then I fell in with a group of artists. You know, I was taking a lot of art classes there, and then I eventually ended up at Minneapolis College of Art and Design and got a BFA there in fine art.
Yeah. And then when did the installation art aspect of you come in?
I started making installations there. Really, I was doing sculpture and installations, and I was taking photography classes mostly. At that point, I was also working as a freelance photo assistant, you know, for advertising photographers. Mm. Photojournalism is something I'd kind of looked into when I was at the university, but there didn't seem to be any way into that. I couldn't find any path into that as a career and couldn't see how I'd fit into it. So, I mean, I've known Janet sitting here. We've known each other a long time. We met in art school. We met at the College of Art and Design. But Janet's not going to say anything because she's...
That's fine.
Speak. Okay.
I understand.
I mean, I really don't know how to... I think what happened when I was at the College of Art and Design is I realized that I wasn't so much interested in one medium or another. I was interested in ideas, and I was interested in the response I got from people who saw what I made. I would do a lot of different things. And so photography is a medium, you know, as it's painting and, you know, installation, basically you do all kinds of things. So really, because of the times and where I was able to make a variety of things with different tools that had conceptual connections. I did a few installations when I was a student, an undergraduate student, but not a lot of them. Most of the things I were making as art were objects. I made a whole series of funny little fountains out of cement and fur. Yeah, and some of them warmed up. Right, and they made, sometimes a lot of them made, they were kind of like, if you take the idea of a fountain and you decide what would be the antithesis of a fountain, a lot of them were the antithesis of a fountain. They were, so they were funny.
Cool.
Sometimes, yeah. And then I took, when I got out of school, I got hired right away. I had a portfolio by then, you know, commercial portfolio. Oh. So I got hired by a department store chain. They had a photo studio, and I did product photography, everything from underwear on models to jewelry to, you know, whatever. Back in the day when we shot film.
Right.
You know, large
expensive
format.
Eight
by wealth. You know, this is what you did for advertising. Mm-hmm. So I'd go into a studio and I'd spend all day with, you know, a whole group of people. There were a lot of us in there working. And I'd shoot the pictures that you'd see in the Sunday Circular or, you know, wherever they'd need advertising photographs. So I did that. And that felt very restrictive.
I can imagine.
It was a little crazy. But there was a recession at the time, and it was hard to get any jobs in photography. And I got hired right out of school, so I felt really lucky.
Yeah.
And then I saw an ad for another job. It was a blind ad. I didn't know who it was for, but it looked really interesting. It was producer/photographer, multi-image shows and things like that. So I applied, and it turned out it was this big ad agency, and they had a small department that did basically photography and anything audiovisual kind of. Audiovisual is a bad word because you think of a guy with a metal cart and a projector. It wasn't that. It was, they got hired. I became a producer/photographer. Test commercials, for instance.
Gotcha.
I'd go out and I'd shoot photomatics. You know what those are? Being an editor? Stills. We'd take a storyboard. They'd give me a storyboard.
That's a while back. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'd take the storyboard and we'd get actors and we'd get locations and I'd go out and shoot every scene, but as stills. And then they would cut those into a reel. They'd make stills out of other commercials, a clutter reel, and they'd put it all together. And then they'd test them in front of audiences and find out which concept the audience liked best or responded to best. And then from that, they'd go off and they'd make the commercial. So I did those, and I did multiple slide projector, multi-image shows. I don't know if you know what those are.
I think I've seen a couple
of those. Up to like 12, 15 projectors.
Yeah.
Where they're all synchronized by, and this is before personal computers, but we had a computer, and that thing would, an AVL Eagle, and that thing would run these projectors. So I'd shoot some of that. You know, I'd also have to hire a crew to, you know, put it together. And so I learned how to budget things. We had a writer, but sometimes I'd write smaller scripts, shoot, direct these things, whatever. So I did that for a couple of years, and I was working. I remember one week I came home, geez, I'm tired. And I looked back and realized I'd worked 110 hours.
Well, that would kind of, yeah, put you out.
So the problem was, is, you know, I had this idea that I could work for money and then also be an artist. And that wasn't happening.
No, you can't.
I mean,
I was actually.
I mean, I had a studio and I was making these sculptures out of cement and things. But it was just crazy. I didn't have time to really do the art.
Well, then, did the question of quality come into play then, too, when you're working that many hours in your own mind?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, what do you mean quality?
Did you feel that one might be sacrificing for the other?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, so, you know, I was still making art, but the problem was I wanted to work on it more, but I was also making good money, and I, you know, you kind of look and you go, well, this is a career.
Right.
I had a career. And then you go, well, is this really the right career? And in my case, it really wasn't. So I started applying. My way out was, well, I'll go to graduate school. Yeah, so I applied to some graduate schools. I was lucky enough to get accepted to the University of California in San Diego.
Wow.
Which was a good place. They even gave me a fellowship. So it meant that I didn't have to really, the terms were good. Let's put it that way.
That's excellent.
Yeah. I was a teaching assistant the last year. I was there 3 years. So the last year I did that because that's part of getting the degree. But mostly I could just, you know, work. I did, you know, odd jobs and stuff to make some pocket money, but it didn't cost me a lot. And it was not a cheap school, so
right.
I didn't have to deal with that. It was nice. The University of California at the time, I really kind of lost touch, frankly. I'm not, you know, plugged into them anymore. But what was nice about that program was it wasn't media specific. If I decided I wanted to start painting in acrylics, they wouldn't care, as long as it had conceptual unity, you know, as long as what I was doing made sense. And believe me, those guys were good at making sense of a lot of things, so it was a nice place. It attracted people with really interesting ideas.
Well, and probably similar like minds too.
Or very diverse.
Yeah.
It was funny to get there because I remember they were showing me this. I'd already visited, of course, but then when I got there, they give you a studio, and they had a couple of buildings that had studio space for the graduate students. And the space that I was in, there was a sign outside, and it said Red Wing. And I thought, wow. Red Wing? I'm from Red Wing.
Right.
It didn't mean that. It meant that was the commies.
Oh. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, there were a lot of really radical leftists there. So they assumed, because of where I was from, that I was probably very conservative and very right-wing. And I don't know, maybe relatively I am, but it was a funny thing to be typecast just on the basis of where I was from.
It's funny.
I always was kind of branded as a Midwestern hick out there.
Really?
Pretty much, yeah.
I wonder if they still do that. Yeah. Possibly.
Probably.
Probably.
In New York, yeah. They do it. In New York, they do it.
Oh, yeah. I used to have people come up to me and say, where are you from? Because of how blonde I am.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like I was fresh off the boat.
Well, you look like a Swede.
I know, yeah. But there's no Swedish in me whatsoever. Isn't that weird?
You still look like a Swede. It doesn't matter.
So now you're a cameraman. It's like video, though.
Well, DP. I mean, they call us DPs. I don't know if that, you know, director of photography is the common term. It's kind of a corruption of what it really means, because, you know, you've been in the business, you know what a DP really is.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do work like that, but generally I'm a cameraman, yeah.
So how long have you been doing the DP work or the camera work for?
In the late 80s, I was married to somebody else. And we started an alternative gallery in the Twin Cities. It was called No Name Gallery. You want to hear this story?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I'm interested.
What happened was, you know, I finished graduate school and Lori and I decided, hey, let's move back to the Twin Cities, because we looked at L.A. because we were close to L.A. And we also looked at New York, because in Chicago, those are the places you go if you make art. And really, the Twin Cities just seemed like a better deal. I mean, for instance, if you're starting out, you can get grant support. Studio space was cheap. There are other artists. In the big cities, I mean, you find some really cool ideas, but it can take years to kind of get into
Well, yeah.
Get hooked up with people. And we thought, well, if we, you know, I've already got ideas. I want to really make art. So the Twin Cities was a great place to go. And we came back and I was able to get some freelance work, you know, pay the bills. And Lori got an office job. You know, within a few months, we were able to find a studio in a warehouse. And where we could live and afford the rent. And we lived there for a while. And she kept saying, you know, I think it'd be cool to start a gallery. And I'm like, oh, God, you don't know what that means. I mean, that's a lot of work. You know, forget it. And so the idea kept bouncing around. And that building was finally sold for condos. That's what always happens. We found another building. And that building was right down by the river. I don't know if you know where the big bridge is, the Hennepin Avenue Bridge.
Yes, I do.
We were about a block away.
Really?
In a building called the Skunk House.
Nice.
Which now is called Foster House. It's one of the oldest buildings there. It's an old fur warehouse. It was built in the 1880s. And the guy that owned that building had an office on the second floor. He's an older guy. He was a bookie. Well, I mean, you know, here I'm saying this on the radio. I don't know. You know, I think he's long gone. But basically that was his deal, is he made a sports book. And nicest guy in the world. And he had a building full of artists and a sign outside, hung outside that said Skunk House. He called himself the head skunk. And so, you know, we proved to him we could pay the rent, and we rented this space. We had most of the first floor. It wasn't a huge building, and it was a rickety old thing. I mean, I had to basically build an apartment in there.
Okay.
You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, no, I know what you mean.
We had a gas heater, you know, because all the boiler had been torn out of the building. It was, everybody had their own heater, and God, it could have burned at any moment.
Man, anything could have gone.
Mm-hmm. And so the thing is the front of the building had this old storefront, this really cool storefront with windows on the side and in the front and this old creaky wood floor. It's a perfect place for a little alternative gallery because First Avenue, this is right at the end of First Avenue. You go further down First Avenue and all the galleries were there. And every month there was a gallery crawl. So all the gallery openings were coordinated and we thought if we can open our own little gallery in the storefront, then you get people.
Yeah.
Because you know, you don't want to have a gallery where nobody comes.
Or that's nobody biggest, knows about it.
That's the biggest problem with alternative galleries is nobody goes. You know, I mean, so you want to have a scene. The scene was already there. So I thought, well, let's try to do this. Well, he would not rent to us. And I think the reason he didn't want to rent to anybody. It had been empty for years. And I think the reason was he kind of didn't want to call attention to himself in his little building.
Well, yeah.
So one day I went up to pay my rent and he said, Jimmy, do you know how to do electrical wiring? Because he'd already seen that I built our own apartment inside his building. You know, I put in a kitchen, a bathroom, and everything.
Walls.
Exactly. Yeah. All of it. So he said, do you think you could do some wiring for me? I said, John, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm not an electrician. He says, oh, don't worry about that. He says, I just need some smoke alarms installed. You're crazy. I can't do that.
You got to be, like, certified to do that, don't you?
Well, again, it's been 20 years. Yeah. I can tell this story and nobody will get in trouble. But I bought a conduit bender and learned how to bend conduit and went to the lumberyard and bought these smoke alarms and I wired the whole place up. And then he called the fire department and they came over and tested it. Because you see, just between you and me, I think what was going on, I don't know, I'm not going to name any names here, but I think he was making book for the guys down at City Hall. He was a sports bookie.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm not, well, like I say, it's just a story.
Right.
You can call it fiction if you want, but
right.
I wouldn't have been telling this story 20 years ago.
Right.
So anyhow, what happened was we weren't allowed to live in that building legally.
Right.
It was illegal. And City Hall wasn't that far away. And for whatever reason, I mean, I was never told outright, but they told him he had to have an alarm system. And he didn't want to pay to have a big alarm system. They just said, well, it has to work. We don't care where it comes from. We just want to make sure it works. So they came over in the fire truck and got out and did their testing and everything was cool. And that was that.
Excellent.
They just didn't want the building full of artists to burn down. They didn't care how he got his alarm system. And he didn't tell them. And then when it was over, he gave us the gallery for a year.
Sweet deal.
And at the same time, I got a Bush Fellowship for my work. Well, a Bush Fellowship basically allows you to not work for, you know, a period of time. In my case, it was a year and a half where I could just make art. So I was going to be in the studio a lot, and we had the storefront attached, empty. So that's how we started No Name Gallery.
Cool.
Yeah, we had our year's worth of rent, and really that extended to a couple years of free rent. He ended up liking it. You know, it made his building look good, and There were no problems. And so we did it as a volunteer, as an experiment. We went out and looked for artists to show. And Lori did most of the curating. I curated a couple of shows. And we'd have openings every month, and we showed all kinds of stuff. And then, I don't know, I guess it was 89, I had a show at Walker Art Center. That was during that period, a big show. My career was kind of moving along. So we didn't want to show our own stuff there. It was just basically to find things that we were interested in. And we found a whole cool group of volunteers. There was a whole scene that developed. And those volunteers, when we finally moved out of the warehouse a few years later, by then we had incorporated it as a nonprofit. And they took it over. And it still exists, but it's not called No Name Gallery.
Okay.
It's called the Soap Factory. I don't know if
you've ever seen that. I know about the Soap Factory.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Yes. And the strangest thing is that, you know, through all the stuff that happened afterwards, we became disconnected. We ended up getting divorced. We had a kid, you know, all the things. And I went through a couple of other changes in what I do. And that just kept moving along. They found a building. They were given a building. I think it happened when Pillsbury and General Mills, what was it? Do you know, I think General Mills bought Pillsbury or something. Whatever happened is when that big merger happened, there were other companies involved, and one of them was a soap company or had a soap company. There was an old Victorian era factory down by the university, by the river there, and it was an empty building. One of the people who was working at No Name went looking for studio space, saw rental sign on the building, and the realtor showed it to him, and it was massive and empty. And he said, well, you know, I can't afford this, but I have some friends and we have this thing. And one thing led to another, and No Name Gallery needed a space, and they were given the building because they had a 501c3 nonprofit status.
The Haunted Soap Factory.
The Haunted House on Halloween, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's the funny thing. A couple years ago, Jan's going to start laughing. A couple years ago, I got a phone call from a guy. And again, I had really had almost no connection with. I'd go see a show once in a while. They didn't know who I was. And my ex-wife, she'd go over there once in a while. Once in a while, we'd talk about it, you know. But it was its own thing, and it turned, which is fine. I got a call from a guy, and he said, you know, we're doing a 20th anniversary show here. You know, history show about the place. And we understand that you were part of the collective that started the gallery. And I stopped, and I said, collective? Collective? They'd basically evolved their whole sort of myth about how the organization started, because there'd been this whole, and there'd been people that had put in years on that project, much more time than we had. But over time, this whole myth of the origin had come about, and we were no longer the founders. We were part of a kind of some kind of socialist collective that had banded together and founded it, and it wasn't that way at all.
It's like a bad game of telephone.
Well, a little bad. It was just, at first I was a little irked. I kind of thought, hey, you know, we put a lot into that. Yeah. And then I started to look and I went, well, other people put in even more since then.
Oh, yeah.
And all have kind of gone our own ways. So they had their show. And I think really, I'm not even sure if they believe. I told them the story. I even gave them pictures. I still think they don't believe it.
Maybe they'll listen now.
No, they're not going to hear this.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very cool place. It's evolved into something really neat, and it's very different from what we did. We were kind of sort of anarchist. I mean, we didn't really want to have that much structure. They have a director, they have a staff,
oh, wow.
You know, funding, okay. The whole bit. Yeah, and we were just a group that wanted to kind of experiment with a gallery. But what really gave it staying power were two things. One, we got the nonprofit status, so we could get grants and things for support. And two, one reason we started our own gallery was all the other alternative galleries were basically just vanity galleries. Or that's how they appeared to us. I'm starting a gallery so I can show my work all the time.
Oh, I get what you mean, yeah.
We started a gallery. Our first rule was we'll never show our work here.
So then what happens to your work?
Well, my work, I already had things going on. I had a show at Rifle Sport. You ever hear of Rifle Sport?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a show at Rifle Sport in 86 that was kind of wild because I was making these little scenes out of garbage, basically. They looked like, people said they looked like film noir stills. They had figures that I'd make out of cardboard or wood, and they were lit like 1940s film noir.
Oh, that's cool.
And they were big black and white prints that I'd make. Anywhere from maybe 3 feet wide to the biggest ones are like 6 by 6 feet. So I had a show at Rifle Sport. I'd started that work in California. I was still in graduate school, and I'd done an installation at the California Museum of Photography and been in some other group shows out there. So I had a body of work, and then when I came here, I continued that, and I got this show. Bill and, what was her name? The two people that ran, the couple that ran Rifle Sport. I'm trying to remember. Bill and Colleen. Yeah, really nice folks. They gave me a show, and so I mounted this show, and it was just the right time, right place. One of the curators from the Walker Arts Center came through and liked the work and brought another curator from Walker. They bought a piece, and they bought a big piece. It was a diptych that was 6 by 12 feet. And then First Banks, which was collecting at the time, bought another big piece, and I sold a couple pieces to individuals. So all of a sudden, there was some buzz around my work. And then after a period of time, I forget how long it was, I got to know the photo curator over at Walker, and he gave me a show there, a solo show. Or actually, it wasn't a solo. It was with an artist from England, but I had a big gallery, and she had another big gallery. So it was pretty cool. So I didn't need to be showing in an alternative gallery, because actually by the time we really got No Name started, I had a gallery in New York that was in Soho that was representing me, and I had a solo show there, 88 or 89. That lasted a little while, but
pretty accomplished. I mean, you got your hand in a lot of different pots, so to
kind
speak.
Of, yeah. Well, and then kind of what happened with the photographs is I'd been doing them for maybe 6 or 7 years, and the dealer in New York, you know, when they take you on, it's an investment. You aren't represented by a gallery like that unless they think they can make money on you. And that's the whole point. And her thing was she'd been around quite a while. She had older artists, she had dead artists, she had some Russian constructivist stuff she sold. Helen Frankenthaler, was her dealer. And they always have a couple of young, you know, I was one of the young artists. And the thing was, well, you've got to basically start tailoring your output to what we need. And then it'd be a good idea if you moved here. And they had another artist from South Dakota who had moved to Manhattan. And I talked to her about it. And I just couldn't see moving to New York. And they weren't saying, we'll move you to New York. They just thought it would be a good idea if I was there.
Yeah.
At that point in my life, I realized I'm a Midwesterner. You know, I mean, I like New York, but I don't want to live there.
So you stay here.
Yeah, so we stayed in the Twin Cities. And then along about the same time, I realized that the photographs were getting kind of stale for me. I didn't want to be a guy who makes these photographs for the rest of my life. What I was really interested in was narrative, you know, stories. Mm-hmm. And also, in kind of sometimes kind of not such a direct way, like using objects or a situation to tell a narrative. And that's what the photographs were really about. But they had become kind of this, well, one of the big fallout I had with Rosa, the woman who owned the gallery, was after my show, they were contacted by this guy, you know, Fendi?
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy that did the windows for the Midtown Fendi store got a hold of him and said, I want some of these pictures for the windows. I'm like, well, that's it. She was all excited about it. And I was like, well, all well and good, but I don't think that's a good way to show this work. He has a backdrop for perfume and stuff.
It's not your intention.
No.
No.
You know, and that's, you know, if I want to do that, I might as well just go back and get a job at an ad agency. I don't, you can sell it, but I gotta, if it's art,
it should be
in
the forefront.
I should have something to say about how it's shown. That's the whole point. I mean, you know, I can take a urinal and put it on the wall and call it art. But I don't want my pictures used as a urinal.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. A big thank you to Jim Tittle for joining us today on Art Beat. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of our interview.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at KQAL.org.